The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled The Enduring Spirit of Butler Island, text by Melissa L. Cooper. In Georgia, descendants of people enslaved on the infamous plantation struggle to preserve the site's complicated history and honor the region's rich culture. The route that runs straight through Darien, Georgia, and cuts across the marshes, rivers, and creeks along coastal McIntosh County, leads to a historic site, Butler Island, a once vast antebellum plantation. Drivers unfamiliar with this stretch of U.S. Highway 17 likely pay little attention to the remains of a 75-foot brick chimney that powered the old rice mill or the huge kiln nearby, both planted in the lush landscape of palmetto trees and marsh grass. The 1,500-acre Tidewater Plantation was originally purchased in 1793 by Major Pierce Butler, signer of the United States Constitution, whose grandsons, Pierce Meese Butler and John Meese Butler, inherited the property and the people enslaved there. Relying on agricultural knowledge passed down to them by their ancestors, who honed their techniques in West Africa's rice-growing region, stretching from present-day Senegal to Liberia, the captives on Butler Island waded through boggy and marshy fields, doing intensive, grueling work to produce the rice crop that made coastal planters rich. Today, all that remains to acknowledge the hundreds who maintained the residence and worked the land is a historical marker erected in 2019 that shares a brief story of the, quote, enslaved people of Butler Island, end quote. Dehumanization and suffering were inherent effects of slavery, and some of the agonies Butler Island's enslaved population endured were documented by Frances Anne Kemble, Pierce Meese's Butler's wife, a well-known British actress who spent the winter of 1838 to 1839 on the plantation. The couple typically resided in Philadelphia. Absent any detailed testimonies from Butler Island's enslaved residents, Kemble's record singularly sheds light on the everyday conditions there. She recalls the pitiful sight of black women in the property's infirmary, most of them on the ground, some, quote, too ill to rise, end quote. Kemble was stunned into the realization that, quote, here in their hour of sickness and suffering lay those whose health and strength are spent in unrequited labor for us, those who, perhaps even yesterday, were being urged on to their unpaid task, end quote. Kemble became an outspoken abolitionist, which reportedly played a role in her 1849 divorce from Butler. Through it all, the enslaved individuals on the Butler's plantation made families and community, passing on what remained of their forebears' traditions, such as hand-weaving baskets used to winnow rice, through the generations and adding more than captivity and suffering to the meaning of the place. That's what made the events of March 2nd and 3rd, 1859, especially catastrophic. To pay off gambling debts and financial losses, Pierce Meese Butler sold 436 black people, a portion of those he enslaved on Butler Island, along with some from his nearby Hampton Plantation, a major cotton-producing farm. The auction of enslaved people, held at 10 Broeck Racecourse in Savannah, was among the largest in American history. Anne C. Bailey, a historian and the author of a book about that auction, writes that the mass sale and its aftermath came to be known as the weeping time, ripping apart families in the community forged on the island and scattering some of its members across the South. Moreover, not only did the Butler auction represent, quote, a traumatic breach in family bonds, end quote, for those who were bought and sold, Bailey writes, but it also severed a link, quote, between present and future generations, end quote. After the Civil War, the Butler Island Plantation would never again achieve the same scale of agricultural production. The Butler estate was passed down in the family until it was sold in 1923, becoming a vegetable and dairy farm before changing hands again. Today, the island is the property of the Georgia Department of Natural Resources. Descendants of those who remained on Butler Island after the auction consider it a sacred place for ancestral remembrance. Down every road in McIntosh County, there is some history, says Eunice Moore, an 85-year-old lifelong Darien resident who believes her ancestors were once enslaved on the Butler Island Plantation. A former member of Darien's city council and a representative on the local historic preservation board, Moore has advocated to keep Butler Island's history alive. She is a regular honored guest at local Black history events and commemorations, dressed in African-style attire that she says pulls my culture to me. For residents descended from people enslaved on Butler Island and other low country plantations, the customs of their ancestors are instilled in their culture. They point to hand-woven sweetgrass and palmetto baskets, rice fanners, intricately crafted fishing nests, musical customs such as the ring shout, singing spirituals while keeping the rhythm by pounding a stick and marching in a circle, spiritual traditions such as baptismal seeking rituals, and patterns of speech and syntax that can all be traced back to African influences and cultures sometimes known today as Gullah Geechee. Amy Lotson Mitchell, another coastal Georgia native, has been a key figure in preserving local Black history. She calls herself a quote-unquote memory keeper. Born and raised in St. Simons, a nearby island settled by members of the emancipated Black community from local plantations, Mitchell is now the historian for the St. Simons African American Heritage Coalition. She was instrumental in saving the historic Harrington School, a one-room structure built on St. Simons in the 1920s to serve three Black communities. A few years ago, she published a book, co-written with historian Patrick Day Holliday, Gullah Geechee Heritage in the Golden Isles. The old rice plantation on Butler Island also has personal significance for Mitchell. Her paternal ancestors are from McIntosh County and may have been enslaved there. She says all Black Americans, not just those with family ties to the plantation, should learn about it. Our people need to know what struggle we had. For the communities around Georgia's coast, the struggle continues, as efforts to preserve local history have grown urgent. Residents face increasing challenges, not the least, which is their displacement. The encroachment of developers and the quote-unquote heirs' property crisis, which is marked by the forced sales of family homesteads passed down without a will, make the future of these culturally rich areas uncertain. Tax hikes and new proposed zoning regulations may also drive out residents hoping to preserve the area's history. Other dangers also threaten these historically significant sites. In 2020, a bill put forward to the Georgia State Legislature would have opened Butler Island and other heritage sites statewide to private sale. One proposal, which would have turned the plantation into a distillery, was protested by Butler Island descendants and preservation groups, including the recently formed Coalition to Save Butler Island Plantation and House. Moore was among those who fought against the sale. The bill died in the state Senate. Then last summer, the 1920s-era mansion on the site was set on fire, allegedly by a burglar, and destroyed. Meanwhile, intensifying and damaging storms are battering coastal neighborhoods, and rising seas threaten to submerge Butler Island and other heritage sites. But Moore, Mitchell, and other leaders refuse to lose faith, vowing to continue to keep the memory of their ancestors alive. Some of these things we can't erase, says Moore. You might want to cover them up, but you can't erase it. It's still there. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Rites of Winter by Jenny Rothenberg Gritz. On the Italian island of Sardinia, carnival season revolves around nature, community, and mysterious traditions. The first time Salvatore Gongui transformed into Mammothon, he was 14 years old. He pulled on the traditional leather-soled shepherd's boots, velvet pants and jacket, and wrapped himself in a heavy cloak. Across his chest, he strapped a cluster of bells that weighed more than 60 pounds. He felt a strange mix of emotions as he paraded through the streets, a somber mask covering his face. There was my grandpa and my mama and papa and also my uncle, and they were so proud, recalls Gongui, more than four decades later. And yet, he adds, it was a horrible day. I was tired and scared because it was such a long parade. I remember my feeling was, I can't do it anymore. I can't. But I carried on. The Parade of Mammothons is an annual winter tradition in the Italian village of Mamoiada. The village of around 2,300 is in the heart of Sardinia, an Italian island about 175 miles from the mainland. By comparison, Sicily is only 2 miles from the mainland. While Italian is the island's official language, Sardinians also speak a separate Latinate language that most Italians struggle to understand. In villages like Mamoiada, just about all the income is related to either agriculture or tourism. The parade, the Mammothons, is one of the largest tourism draws of the entire year, even though it isn't especially cheerful. It's serious and in some ways sad carnival, Gongui told me. If the phrase Italian carnival brings to mind a cast of playful characters, Harlequin with his multicolored diamonds, Pierrot with his oversized buttons, the plague doctor with his bird-like beak, you're probably thinking of Venice. The first recorded carnival took place there in 1094. The festival had a Christian tie-in as a burst of hedonism before the austerity of Lent. The word carnevale means taking out the meat, implying one last decadent feast. During the Roman festival of Saturnalia, ancestors of today's Italians drank and indulged and turned the social order upside down. Masters served their slaves, and an elected king gave orders to everyone. Throughout the Middle Ages, carnivals popped up all over Europe and later spread across the ocean in New Orleans and Rio de Janeiro. European Jews may well have been influenced by these pre-Lent festivals when they turned their late winter holiday of Purim into a night of costumes, theatrics, and topsy-turvy hierarchies. The festival of Mammothons is not part of the same carnival tradition, though it has its own Christian association. It starts on the eve of January 17th, the feast day of St. Anthony the Abbot, a legendary saint who had an austere life in the wilderness and lived to be 105. But this is a pagan festival, Gongui told me. Everybody knows it has nothing to do with Christianity. It's unclear when the parade originated or when the word mammothon even means. The character itself has a distinct appearance. The most startling part of the costume is the mask, with its severe and labored expression. Another set of characters, called Isahadores, literally rope bearers, march along with the mammothons slinging lassos. The Isahadores wear a different mask, blankly white and unsmiling. In an email, Elena Guanguillo and Alice Maida, the scientific director and assistant director of Mammoiada's Museum of Mediterranean Masks, explained that the parade belongs to a tradition of festivals that are profoundly serious and solemn, unlike the modern carnival, which is lighthearted and fun. There are other winter parades like this in villages throughout Europe. In the Portuguese Intrudo Festival, the locals wear terrifying masks and chase people through the streets. In some German-speaking villages, people celebrate Krampusnacht, or the Night of the Krampus, with a devil-like figure who roars at children and threatens to carry them away in his sack. Heavy clanging cowbells are a theme at many of these events, all of which are less about merriment than exercising the forces of evil, as the museum directors put it. The somber procession of the mammothones may have its roots in Nuragic civilization, which began almost 4,000 years ago. In Venice, Rio, and New Orleans, outlandish disguises give revelers a chance to flaunt their own individuality. But in Mamoida, there's a striking uniformity as rows of mammothones and isojadores parade together wearing the same two masks. Instead of upending the social order, the Sardinian carnival seems to reinforce it. "We feel like we're in a trance," Gungui told me. "We don't look at the other people. It's just about all of us together as a group." The mammothones and the isojadores come out three times each winter. Two of those times are scheduled to coincide with the traditional Italian carnival season, the Sunday and Tuesday before Lent. Those performances are tourist events geared toward the public, as villagers march during the daytime along the town's main road. But the official event is much more intimate. On the eve before January 17th, the mammothones and isojadores weave through the whole village at night, circling dozens of bonfires. Villagers spend weeks ahead of time collecting roots and stumps for these blazes. They then gather around them to roast pigs and share one another's company. The holiday gives the community a chance to make sure all of their relations are good, Gungui explained. Their livelihood depends on it. All throughout the year, Sardinian villagers work together in cooperatives, tending their vineyards and olive orchards and raising pigs for ham and salami. When a farmer needs help, the others pitch in. Everybody knows how much is at stake. I got a glimpse of this in mid-September, when Gungui sent me a message apologizing that he had to postpone our planned phone conversation. The forecast was predicting a big storm, he explained, and he and his neighbors needed to quickly harvest their grapes or they lose a year's work. He elaborated when we spoke a few days later. "The weather rules everything," he said. "Lately, with the changing climate, summers have been hot and dry. No rain at all for 6 months. Everything was suffering. When the rain does come now," he went on, "it's no normal rain. It's like a tropical rain. When January arrives, people are more anxious than ever about the upcoming growing season. Can you imagine how we feel about the weather?" he asks. "It's not like in a city where you put up an umbrella and everything is all right." Gungui has some experience with cities and umbrellas. As a younger man, he spent a few years in Wales and London, working as a carpenter. It was an easier life in some ways, but especially when the seasons changed, he felt the pull of his native landscape. Sardinia is known as a blue zone, one of five spots on the globe where people live an unusually long time. This could be partly because Sardinians naturally live according to guidelines for longevity that doctors recommend. They eat locally and cherish their communal gatherings. "I missed a lot," Gungui said. "I took all my holidays in January just to make sure I could have a role in the festival." Gungui has dressed up as a mammothone just about every year since he was 14. Apart from the festival's one-year hiatus during COVID-19 lockdowns, he only missed a couple of years, and the last of those was a quarter century ago. There are men as old as 80 who still strap on the furs and the heavy bells, hiding their faces behind those gloomy masks. Whether or not they're banishing evil spirits and appeasing the forces of nature, their survival feels tied to this ritual, its power, its clamor, its sense of connection. "I intend to carry on," Gungui told me, "until I can't anymore." Next, we'll move on to an article in the prologue section by Brendan Fitzgerald. It's called "Listening to the Land." An inventive composer is on a mission to evoke Virginia's past through strange medleys of sounds. In early 2020, Daniel Bachman stood at the edge of a creek in Falmouth, Virginia, recording the sounds of the insects chittering and buzzing around him. He came to the creek for a history it held. Nearby, slate-colored markers identified the site as the area where an English naval officer had kidnapped Pocahontas in 1613. Markers flanked a section of U.S. Route 1, still named at the time for Jefferson Davis, the lone president of the Confederate States of America. Bachman, then 30 years old, had already won national acclaim and toured throughout the United States and Europe with a sprawling collection of vernacular guitar music spread across more than a dozen releases. Fans in the music press had likened him to the legendary John Fahey, known as one of America's great guitarists for his avant-garde approach to traditional music. Bachman's songs, rags, reels, and country blues, many named for sights and sounds of Virginia, conjured an easy sense of the past. But Bachman had grown wary of nostalgia. How could his music communicate a richer, more complicated legacy? He committed himself to studying the history of his home state, digging deep into pre-colonial narratives and regional customs, befriending libraries and folklorists. He sought off locations like that creek in Falmouth, where he listened for the traces of the past, homing in on the animal calls and running waters that recalled previous millennia. At some point, it just clicked. I can literally use these sounds, he says. And he started recording the noises that so inspired him, from Shenandoah National Park to Assateague Island. On the Blue Ridge Parkway, he recorded the creak of a dead pine, the pitch rising to sound almost like a fiddle as the wind pushed through it. In Southampton County, he recorded heavy snippets of radio as he passed Belmont Plantation, where Nat Turner, an enslaved black preacher, led an armed insurrection in 1831. These sounds all resurface on Axican, Bachman's 2021 album, alongside the songwriter's own guitar, fiddle, and harmonium. Every sound on Axican, named for the 16th century Spanish colony near the Chesapeake Bay, Bachman recorded with the geographic boundaries of the failed settlement. The resulting album is a singular musical exploration of Virginia's colonial history. Bachman's home provides both subject and soundtrack. Dead trees become instruments, and bygone voices flicker in and out of reception. With each new album, Bachman seems more obsessed with capturing a world that is slipping away. He stopped touring, instead committing himself to a small piece of Virginia while digging centuries deep in his research, always seeking new echoes of his home's ragged, discordant history. Where his songs once held traces of traditional styles and arrangements, they are now experimental and unruly, brimming with the sounds of the world caught by Bachman as history unfolds in the present. Local history tugged at Bachman from an early age. He grew up in Fredericksburg, a city hemmed by Civil War battlefields, former plantations, and the free-flowing Rappahannock River. His childhood home stands on the site of a Union Army encampment. The land had been part of the plantation where George Washington grew up. His father, John, a paleontology hobbyist, once made national headlines after finding fossilized dinosaur tracks nearby. The family home includes a fossil room, its shelves and boxes filled with their discoveries. If we put a shovel into the ground, we would find little artifacts, says Sarah, Bachman's sister. It was sort of modeled to us that you must understand the environment that you're in as many dimensions as you can. The environment included music. Bachman's father is a guitarist, and the family record collection includes bluegrass, Appalachian folk, and country blues. As children, Bachman and his sister improvised plays about early American history. Sarah portrayed a Union soldier or a time traveler who would uncover artifacts to marvel at. Bachman directed his sister, designed the sets, and documented the performances with the family camcorder. He was always trying to record everything, Sarah says. I feel like he's always had a preservation mindset. When he was 17, Bachman dropped out of high school and devoted himself to making Appalachian folk music. He released a series of full-length albums, their track lists dotted with the names of small places around Virginia, Seven Pines, White Oak, Mount Olive, Cohoke. He made his debut on NPR's popular Tiny Desk concert series in 2012. Music writers praised Bachman for his knack at breathing new life into older styles. History, one critic wrote, runs through Daniel Bachman's guitar. Bachman's engagement with history can be subtle. He doesn't sing or write lyrics. In Bachman's music, there is no human voice to guide the song. Instead, he relies on song titles and liner notes to evoke a sense of place and time. River, his 2015 album, pays homage to the Rappahannock by pairing Bachman's original songs with his arrangements of tunes by Virginia musicians from generations past who knew the same shores. As Bachman distanced himself from the traditional song structures, he sought more direct ways to channel history. Following Axican in 2022, Bachman released Almanac Behind, an album focused on the climate crisis and composed using a range of found sounds, among them weather alerts from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration picked up by his weather radio, voicemail messages from the local power utility, the sound of rain whipping the house to document a year of extreme storms. Almanac Behind is a gripping listen. A year's worth of destructive weather compressed into a 43-minute tempest as the sounds of the near past warn of a perilous future. Nature is no longer aestheticized on the album, one critic observed. It is real, immediate, and dangerous. Bachman, now 35, lives with his partner Aldona Dye, a musicologist, in Madison County, Virginia, on the east side of the Blue Ridge Mountains. The pair met in 2019 while digging through the archives of the Virginia Folklore Society. Their home is a former mill building, which they rent for $600 a month plus utilities. Bachman has rarely made more than $20,000 a year, he says, mainly from landscaping and odd jobs that support his music and folklore interests. I once asked him about whether he considered albums like Almanac Behind to be a form of documentary work. By way of the answer, he brought up People Take Warning, Murder Ballads and Disaster Songs, 1913 through 1938, an anthology in which each song is filed under a broader category heading, Man versus Man, Man versus Machine, Man versus Nature. The songs are vessels for melody and technique, sure, but also for news of real tragedy. Two trains collided in Ingleside, West Virginia in 1927, killing an engineer who worked on the railroad line, the wreck of the Virginian. The 1929 influenza epidemic claimed thousands of lives as death went creeping through the air, Memphis flu. Bachman's commitment to documentation in his music enables the sounds of climate change to speak for themselves. I'm trying to explore how we make art about these things accurately, Bachman told me, how to express the emotional and physical realities of the changes that we're listening to. We know the past through fragments, sonic and otherwise. We managed to save from ruin. The rest goes down with the ship. Last February, Bachman and Dye hosted a two-hour community radio show featuring recordings from the Virginia Folklore Society archives held by the University of Virginia Library. Many of the recordings embossed on fragile aluminum discs have now been digitized, securing them for future listeners. Some of the songs they contain are nearly a century old. At the top of the show, Dye said, "This will be the first time a lot of these will be on the radio." The pair played a folk ballad sung by a woman named Eunice Yates McAlexander and recorded in 1932 before rural electrification. Near the end of the song, a steam whistle sounds. Afterward, Bachman explains that the sound may have been recorded at the train station, where power outlets were more common and accessible back then. It gives another sense of place and time to these recordings. Later in the fall, Bachman bought a handheld recorder and rented a cabin in Shenandoah National Park. He planned to spend a few days there attaching a small contact microphone to trees affected by the Quaker Run fire. What might such ancient trunks thick with history have to say? I thought of the train whistle, nearly a century old, held safe within the body of the song, finally carried across the radio waves like a small revelation. This article has been cut for time. So we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available at a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.